Hi, this is John Horgan, the semi-regular correspondent for Science Saturday on Blogging Heads TV, and with me is one of the most famous skeptics, critical intellectuals in the world, Mike Shermer. So Mike, welcome to Blogging Heads TV.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
Well, I was trying to remember the first time we met. I think it might have been exactly 10 years ago when you invited me out to give a talk to your skeptic audience out there at, I think it's a Caltech room that you rent out.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. That was in 97.
Yeah, we host all of our events, our public events at Caltech. It's just down the street from our office, and it's a great center for science in Southern California. And we have probably one of the largest science audiences in the world, considering we have not only Caltech, but JPL, the NASA JPL facility that has 5,000 scientists and employees, and plus UCLA and USC and all the universities. So it's a pretty good area. And of course, Southern California is pretty well known for its new age nuttiness. So there's a kind of an interesting juxtaposition there between a lot of high-tech, science-y people and a lot of new age weirdos.
Well, I know that the, I've talked in that venue twice, once after The End of Science, I gave a talk on that, and then after my last book, Rational Mysticism, and it's a very tough audience, but a really smart and engaged audience, so I've really had a good time when I've spoken there.
Yeah, they ask good questions, that's for sure.
They do. Mike, I wonder if you've got sort of an interesting history. I guess you went from one extreme to the other on your way to becoming a skeptic. So could you just tell us how you ended up where you are intellectually?
Well, like anyone else, you just, when you're young, you explore a lot of different ideas and try different things. When I wasn't raised in any particular religious belief. My parents were just simply non-religious, and they had no college education at all. So I got no exposure to any of the interesting topics we will probably discuss until college. And there I just tried different things. I had already become a evangelical, what we would today call an evangelical Christian, but then it was just a born-again Christian in high school. So that was 1971, and I was that until 77.
Can you just tell me, how did that happen? Did you have a religious experience?
No, peer group. It was just a typical peer group thing. All my friends were doing it, and so I thought I'd give it a try. But once I gave it a try, it really worked for me at the time. I mean, it was it's classic case of the confirmation bias at work. Once you believe something, you then find reasons to reinforce that belief. You look for confirmatory evidence to support it, and so on. And that's what I did, and the world made a lot of sense in the religious worldview, looking at it through a Christian worldview. And I went to Pepperdine University, which is a Church of Christ, very conservative school. In fact, I was in the first graduating class from the Malibu campus. So, of course, it didn't hurt that it was in Malibu, but but it was very conservative. I mean, Gerald Ford came to speak, and Edward Teller came and gave his mutual assured destruction speech about the importance of nuclear weapons, and there was no dancing allowed on campus. You weren't ever allowed into a dorm room of a member of the opposite sex, and but to me that all made sense in my worldview. But along the way I bumped into science. I was going to major in theology, and then I discovered, because I wanted to be a college professor, then I discovered to get a PhD in theology you had to have master four dead languages, Hebrew, Greek, Latin, and Aramaic, and I could barely get through Spanish. So I switched fields because I had to get a job at some point, and I switched to psychology, experimental psych, and there I was introduced to the methods of science, and that began my long deconversion experience.
Yeah, and so then how, I mean, you really went from one extreme to the other, so why did you decide to recast yourself as a skeptic, as a kind of anti-belief person?
I know it looks that way, but it isn't actually that way at all. It's because most people think of skeptics or skepticism in a negative way, it's really just science. I mean, any scientist is a skeptic. Skeptics are scientists. We have to think of it as a tool. It's like science is a tool to understand the world. Skepticism is a tool that's part of science that basically says the null hypothesis is true. That is, whatever the claim is being made, it's probably not true unless we have evidence to the contrary. And so that's, you know, basic introductory research methodology's assumption. The null hypothesis is what we assume. Now, let's see if we can find evidence to overturn the null hypothesis and therefore support your thesis. And really, that's all skepticism is. It's just saying, that's nice, prove it. Let's look at the evidence. And, you know, we're from Missouri, like President Truman, you know, show me the evidence. Let's take a specific case, Bigfoot. It's not that there can't be a bipedal hirsute primate running around the hinterlands of northwestern United States. There could be. It's just that until we have a body, let's assume that there isn't. And that's all there is to it, really.
When did you decide to found the Skeptic Society and Skeptic Magazine and all that stuff?
Well, there has long been, for the last 35 years or so, a skeptical movement in America led by people like the Amazing Randy and Ray Hyman and other magicians and so forth. And so I remember being in a graduate school in experimental psych, working on a master's degree, and Uri Geller was all the rage. This is the mid to late 1970s, and there were these psychics being tested like Uri by experimental psychologists who had PhDs, and you know, that's what I was training to be. So I figured, well, you know, these guys are probably smarter than I am, and they say there's something to this psychic power, so maybe there is. And then I remember seeing Johnny Carson's Tonight Show one night when the Amazing Randy appeared, and he was able to do everything Uri Geller could do just using magic. So I realized, oh, wait a minute, there's something else going on here, that scientists are trained to understand the world in a certain logical fashion. Nature may be complex and difficult to understand, but she doesn't purposely deceive the way a human does. And so that made me realize that the assumptions on the part of a lot of scientists that these things are true, it has to be further challenged from a different direction, that is, from the skeptic's perspective. And that's what led me ultimately into the skeptical movement, which we started the magazine in 1992.
Why did you decide? So there's also the Skeptical Inquirer, I guess, is the best known skeptic journal. But then there's I think it's called Reason and Free Inquiry. There are these sort of secular humanist journals that are very critical of religion, not so much of parapsychology and all that stuff. But why did you think there was a need for another voice in this whole area?
Well, yeah, there are a lot of different magazines, although they do differ. Like Reason magazine, for example, is a libertarian publication that deals mostly with politics and economics. And Free Inquiry and the Humanist are both humanist magazines. They don't do that much with science, although they do some. But they deal a lot with religion and abortion and First Amendment rights, things like that. And then Skeptical Inquirer and Skeptic are the two main skeptical publications. And I started Skeptic simply because I wanted to do my own thing. It's just sort of the way I am, my personality. I was a college professor at Occidental College in L.A., and I was happy to just do college professing for the rest of my life. It's a great, great gig if you can get it. And
professor of history? Is that right?
I was teaching history of science, yeah. And my PhD is in history of science. So, but then I, we started this the lecture series at Caltech, and we started the Skeptic. It was just sort of a hobby out of my garage. It was just sort of a fun thing. But as it got bigger, and I grew less enchanted with college professing, in 1997, when my book Why People Believe Weird Things did really well, it got me thinking that maybe I could actually do this for a living. And within 2 years, I had made the transition to running the Skeptic magazine full time, and I quit teaching then. So I haven't taught really in almost 10 years now.
I just started teaching 2 years ago, and I'm still in the honeymoon phase, I guess. I still really enjoy it. I must say, it's a challenge. I'm teaching at this engineering school, Stevens Institute of Technology, that has a lot of very conservative students, including young Earth creationists. A lot of kids don't believe in global warming, human-induced global warming. So, which is, for me, it's great. I mean, it's a real challenge. We have very lively discussions in class. So you don't, but you had enough. You don't miss it anymore.
Oh, I miss the lecturing. I like lecturing to audiences. But I have a lecture agent who books me in maybe 24 lecture gigs a year, and that satisfies that need, I guess, to lecture, plus our own Caltech lecture series that I organize. So it's mainly the lecturing, the performance in front of an audience part that I enjoy. Reading.
Yeah, I've seen you. You're really good at it.
Thanks.
And you're great on TV and in radio formats, and you are a performer.
Well, thanks. I learned that from watching people like the Amazing Randy and other professional entertainers. That if you want to get your point across, the way the message is delivered really does matter. The image, all that stuff, makes a difference. We all know that from mass media studies, but it's absolutely true. So one of the things I'm trying to do with skeptics is show that we do have a sense of humor. You have to be funny. Warm and thoughtful and polite. We're not just a bunch of grumpy old white guys complaining about the world, although there are plenty of those. But in fact, the skeptical movement has really shifted toward youth and a diversity of people, not just old white guys, but young people of a great diversity. And because, as I said, skepticism is not a thing. It's just a tool that anybody should apply. And of course, people do. I mean, I was doing a radio interview this morning on 9/11 conspiracy theories, and of course I was debating a guy who is a college professor, a scientist, who doesn't believe that Al-Qaeda did it. He thinks Bush did it, and he had all his rational arguments, and he's skeptical of the government. So in that sense, skepticism can be applied in many directions.
By the way, we haven't mentioned that you're also a columnist for Scientific American, so that must have really expanded your audience.
Yeah, that's about my favorite thing that I do, because they have it's just almost a million readers, and every month they're skeptics. So again, it's just a way of reaching more people. I find the letters probably the most interesting thing that I get whenever I mention something that pushes people's buttons. Because with skeptic, our print run is about 50,000, so the Scientific American's an order of magnitude larger. So that gives me more feedback from people, and that's probably the most enjoyable part of the job, is getting letters just to see what's on people's minds. Even with that readership, though, I was amazed that whenever I write anything about evolution, I do get lots of letters from people saying I should be skeptical of evolution. So that really surprised me.
Well, yeah, I was at Scientific American for about 10 years. I left there in 97, and I had a couple of pieces on parapsychology, and there's one piece in particular where I wrote about a guy at Los Alamos who was in charge of a fairly expensive weapons program, mm-hmm. non-lethal weapons, who had also written a book on how to use your psychic powers to get ahead in business. and so I wrote a piece just mocking him. I mean, it was very light. I intended it to be humorous, but I guess it was kind of vicious as well. And to my surprise, you'd think you're preaching to the converted, writing for Scientific American. I got this flood of letters telling me that I was really close-minded and excessively skeptical toward psychic powers and the paranormal. I just wonder if you've gotten those kinds of responses from Scientific American readers as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I wrote, one of my columns is called The Flipping Point, in which I basically confessed that I had long been a global warming skeptic, and not for any particular good reason. I hadn't really studied it that closely, but it just seemed like the environmental movement had exaggerated everything, and since I'd been in college, they had made all these claims that didn't come true, and I figured, I just don't believe any of that global warming stuff. And then I actually read the data and looked at the articles, and I realized, this is, it's really happening, and it's probably mostly human caused. So that's what I wrote this column about. And I figured that was a sitting duck. I mean, this would just pass by unobserved. Everybody would just say, well, it's about time you got on board. And, of course, I did get some of those letters, but I got hundreds of letters from people just irate, just furious that I would you know, sort of betray the skeptical cause that global warming is a complete total scam. I just briefly mentioned Al Gore and Inconvenient Truth in just one fragment of a sentence. And man, I must have had 24 letters telling me that I was now an ideologue, that I was in the pocket of Al Gore and the left-wing conspiracy against business in corporate America. And they just went on and on about this. And I was amazed about that. There's a lot of readers of Scientific American that don't believe global warming is real.
You know, this is what makes it so difficult to be a skeptic, is that it's really hard and actually impossible to draw the line cleanly between what is credible and what isn't. I mean, there's some things that I think are just obviously beyond the pale. I mean, I don't know if it's even worthwhile writing about something like astrology anymore. Do you cover astrology?
Yeah, no, I don't bother with that stuff anymore because it's all been done so much that, and there's so many other more relevant topics, like, for example, the alleged link between autism and vaccinations that kids got. And now those are...
Where do you stand on that? I'm sort of confused. I mean, I've seen, you know, I read the article by, I think it was Bobby Kennedy, he was saying that the connection is real and he thinks it's been suppressed by the sort of medical establishment. But then the New York Times shortly after that had a debunking article.
So yeah, the Times, I think, has got it right. We have a cover story coming out in our next issue of Skeptic, in which I have a medical researcher basically summarizing all the evidence for and against. And basically, the bottom line is this. They took mercury out of the vaccinations back in the mid-1990s, and rates of autism have been going up ever since. So the correlation is simply not there. And in any case, even if it was, as we know, correlation does not mean causation, there's no causal vector that we know of that would... I mean, we know mercury in high doses is toxic, of course. Water in high doses is toxic. It's the dose that matters, and the doses, even in when they were using mercury, were so tiny that there's no way to know if that is the cause. But the other big problem is autism itself. What is it? I mean, there is no cut and dry. It's not like you either have AIDS or you don't, or you broke your arm or you didn't. It's one of these catch-all categories of illness that gets redefined. And so one reason for the confusion is that it's not clear what constitutes autism. I mean, anything from Asperger's syndrome all the way to completely low-functioning kids that can't even speak. So that has confused the issue. But as far as I can tell, there's no link.
Yeah, it's, you know, the whole area of psychiatric diagnosis is just so murky. There was just a front-page story in the New York Times about an increase in diagnoses of manic depression among children of, I think, about an order of magnitude over the last 15 years or so. I know this also has happened with attention deficit disorder, as you said, with autism and Asperger's. You know, these diagnoses are so arbitrary. There are no really clear physical markers. And so, you know, all of psychiatry is... it's really questionable just how scientific it is.
Yeah, in this next issue of Skeptic that I mentioned, it's all devoted to medical controversies, not alternative medicine, but mainstream medical controversies, one of which I have a psychiatrist that basically says Tom Cruise was right for the wrong reasons, not because Scientology's got it right, but because there is a lot of room for skepticism in psychiatry, not just the overdosing of people to treat mental diseases that way, but just even that concept of a mental disease, I mean, really, what is that? And the fact that, you know, the most obvious example is that homosexuality was considered a disease and on the books as a disease that should be treated all the way up until, I think it was 1973, when it was simply voted out and now it's okay. Well, wait a minute, voted in, voted out, what in the world are you talking about? I mean, that would not happen in other physical medical problems, let's say. So,
right.
Yeah, you're right. It's fraught with problems.
It's a cultural change rather than a medical scientific change. Hey, listen, I was really supposed to talk to you about your new book, which I'd like to segue to now. But first, I just want to... I'm holding up here. You can't see this, of course. A stack I just went over to my bookcase. I have 5 books by you, Mike, and I hope you are flattered because not many authors have that honor. So I've got the Skeptic Encyclopedia of Pseudoscience, Volume 1 and Volume 2. I've got, let's see, Why People Believe Weird Things. Is that still your best-known or best-selling book?
Yep, that's my best-selling book. It's probably sold more than all the others combined.
Really? Wow, it's a great title.
It's used for a lot of classrooms, too. That helps.
Yeah. Well, I've used it a lot as background for my own writing. How We Believe, which is why people believe weird things except directed at religious belief, right?
Yep, that's right.
And then your latest, and of course I'm aware of some of your others. I wanted to talk to you a little bit later about the Science of Good and Evil. Is that? Yes, The Science of Good and Evil. But right now I want to talk about this book. I'm holding it up right now. Why Darwin Matters. So this came out quite recently, right?
Paperback just came out this month, September, and the hardback a year ago. So yeah, that's, it's sort of an interrupted journey simply because of the Dover trial and all the rise of intelligent design. Gracious, I thought I'd written what I had to say and gave my piece in Why People Believe Weird Things. I had a couple chapters in there about creationism and evolution. I figured that would be the end of it because I wrote about the whole chapter on the 1987 Supreme Court case in which the law passed in Louisiana requiring that evolution and creationism be given equal time in public school science classrooms was overturned, and on appeal it went to the U.S. Supreme Court. So it's basically Scopes 2. Scopes never made it to the U.S. Supreme Court, but this one did. And the Supreme Court voted 7-2 to uphold the ban on equal time laws. So when I wrote about that, I figured that's it. I can move on to other subjects. But then in the late 1990s, this whole movement of intelligent design really took off. It's an incredibly brilliant marketing ploy on their part. It's one of those marketing brand names, if you want to call it that, that is what we'd say today is sticky. People get it instantly and it sticks in their mind. Intelligent design, yes, I get that. The watchmaker, yes, I get it. Anybody that doesn't know anything about biology immediately gets intelligent design. So that was very clever. So I wrote that book simply as a response to the new arguments that they've put forth.
Well, Mike, why... This is a question I have about this book, but really about all your other writings as well, and Skeptic Magazine. I guess the problem that I see is preaching to the converted. Are you, so you're writing for people primarily, I would think, were already on your side. Is there any evidence that you're changing minds with... Well, let's start with this particular book, Why Darwin.
Well, of course, I don't do any surveys, but anecdotally, I get a lot of mail from people that say they weren't sure what to think about it, and now they've come to understand whatever it is the subject is of the book I wrote, and that changed their mind. Almost never do I get anybody that was on the other side that says, I read your book and changed my mind. That I don't expect to happen, and it rarely does. So my audience, which is the audience of Skeptic Magazine, is that, well, we divide the world into thirds. So let's say one-third people are skeptics, one-third people are true believers, and the one-third in the middle aren't sure what to think. They've heard of some particular claim. They haven't really given it that much thought. They're open to the likeliest explanation once they hear it. And so that's the audience we're after, and I think those are the people I hope to reach. The skeptics are already on our side. The true believers aren't going to be converted in any case. So, but that's a pretty vast middle ground, I think, on most subjects.
Well, maybe you can summarize what's in your earlier books, Why People Believe Weird Things and How We Believe, when you respond to my next question, which is, we've had this flood of books, going back to Darwin, really, explaining the world in scientific terms, in terms of evolution and physical laws and so forth. And many of these books explicitly say there's no need for a creator, certainly not an active creator who's constantly meddling in art fairs or in nature in general, and yet you still have, especially in this country, this highly technological, well-educated country, a tremendous number of people who prefer to hold on to what you and I think of as completely irrational, superstitious beliefs. Why is that? I mean, you know, you've got, there's you, there's Richard Dawkins, there's this whole wave of books. And I can't believe that you're actually really reducing the number of people who believe in, you know, the God of the Bible.
Mm-hmm. Well,
why is that? Why is it so hard to change people? And it's not just uneducated people. As you know, there are highly educated, scientifically trained people. Francis Collins, head of the Human Genome Project, who still hold on to, you know, evangelical Christian beliefs.
Yeah, well, in Collins' case, he doesn't. He's not just still holding it. He converted pretty late in life. And the short answer, well, in my book, Why People Believe Weird Things, I have the last chapter is Why Smart People Believe Weird Things. And the short answer is because they're better at rationalizing beliefs they arrived at for non-smart reasons. Which is to say that most of us, most of the time, for most of the beliefs we hold them not for rational, logical reasons, but for emotional, psychological reasons. That is, we were raised to believe that way, or our peer groups influenced us to believe that way, or we're influenced by our mentors or teachers or books that we've read or leaders that we look up to or social groups that we're a part of. And then we back into the belief after we've committed to it, and then find reasons to believe it. So what I argue with the intelligent design arguments, for example, is these are pretty good arguments if you already believe. If you don't already believe, they don't hold water at all. And so it's really a form of rationalization. And it's, I don't mean that as a put-down. Everybody does it. Including you and I and all scientists and so on. Everybody, we're human. That's what we do. We look for and find evidence to support what we already believe. The difference with science is that if you don't find your biases that are clouding your thinking, somebody else will, usually in a public forum with great glee, debunk you. Science, as you know, is a very competitive, thick-skinned enterprise, and there's a reason for that. Because of all the cognitive fallacies and biases we're all subject to, you have to have those checks and balances. And so what religious people are doing in using intelligent design arguments to support their religious beliefs is no different from what, say, conservatives do to support their Republican beliefs, or Democrats do to support their liberal beliefs, or what anybody does. That's just what we do. And so it shouldn't surprise us.
Mike, let me just ask you about your own spiritual beliefs now, such as they are. I've got an essay somewhere. Look, I've got, again, you're not going to see this, I am now holding up my Shermer file. So not only do I have a giant pile of your books, but you have your own file in my filing cabinet. So again, you should be very flattered. But I've got this essay in here that you wrote for one of these Templeton rags, Science and Spirit. I've written for them too. And it starts by saying, I am an atheist. Now, I thought you've told me, and in fact, I thought that I've seen you describe yourself elsewhere as an agnostic. So I just wondered, you know, what you are right now.
Yeah, well, the labels are troublesome. And the reason I wrote that one was simply because in How We Believe, when I said, well, I'm an agnostic in the sense that Huxley meant it, who coined the term in 1869, it's an insoluble problem. There's no scientific test we're going to run and say, oh, look, yes, there is a God, or no, there isn't a God, or anything like that. It's just not part of science. You can't test it in the laboratory. So that's what I meant when I said that. Well, I got a lot of flack from atheists, of course, said that that's too wishy-washy, and the general public does not think of agnosticism in the way Huxley meant it. Most people perceive that word to mean you're still waiting for more evidence. It could go either way, like global warming. Is human caused or it isn't, let's run some more experiments. Well, I don't mean that. So if you mean, you know, by atheism, I don't believe in God, well then okay, I guess I'm an atheist or a non-theist or non-believer, or, you know, the labels are troublesome because they're so loaded with baggage. most Americans also perceive the word atheist to mean is, you know, you're a left-wing liberal communist, you know, you believe in sex, drugs, and rock and roll and abortion, and they lump all this other stuff in that I don't believe and that I don't care to be associated with. And so I just simply say, you know,
you don't care to be associated with sex, drugs, and rock and roll?
Maybe the rock and roll part. well, so, you know, do I believe in God? No, I don't. I mean, maybe there's some higher thing, entity, force, or whatever, that breathed the fire into the equations, as Stephen Hawking likes to say. Something like that, maybe, I don't know. But it's so far afield from what anybody means by God that it's, for practical purposes, I don't believe in the God that most people believe in. And and since it's not something that's part of science, there's really nowhere else to go with it unless I have a personal revelation, which I haven't had. You know, who knows where the universe came from? And it's the fact that we don't know where the initial Big Bang material came from. Well, then, you know, it's just okay to say, I don't know, let's work on the problem some more, rather than construct an entire religion around that particular.
You know, I was, I hung out with Richard Dawkins at one of these, at a Templeton Fellowship for Journalists a couple of summers ago.
He writes about that. He writes about that in The God Delusion.
That's right, and he described himself there as an agnostic rather than an atheist, because he said, just as we can't know that God exists through science, we can't disprove the existence of God. I find that most skeptics I know don't describe themselves as atheists. I know very few people who use the word atheist to describe themselves.
Well, for good reason, John. I mean, in America, it's a real negative label, which is why a lot of atheists are trying to change it. I mean, it's like, why don't homosexuals call themselves fags or queers? Well, because it's a nasty word now in our culture, so let's pick a different word. They started using gay, and that's become more acceptable, and that's why a lot of atheists are in search of a different word. The word bright was the wrong word. but in principle, the search for a new label is certainly a good thing.
Well, Mike, let me tell you why I don't call myself an atheist. I describe myself as an agnostic, and the reason is that the design arguments actually appeal to me to a certain extent. I mean, I think intelligent design, the way it's been presented now, is foolish. But I, actually, at the end of Why Darwin Matters, you describe a sensation that I often have as well, of this sort of sense of awe and wonder, and this recognition of the incredible beauty and intricacy of nature. And I think that wonder leads to an obvious question: where did this come from? Was there a purpose to it? Was it designed in some sense? Do we have a special role in it? The reason why no concept of God that I've encountered makes sense to me is, you know, what's traditionally called the problem of evil. So life is so sort of random and unfair, and even seemingly cruel, but it's not. It's a cruelty of indifference. You have this wonderful quote of Richard Dawkins that puts it that way. On the other hand, life is so wonderful, very often, and beautiful, and there are so many things that make my life worth living. It's kind of the flip side of the problem of evil, the problem of beauty and fun, that makes it impossible for me to completely rule out the existence of a creator. So I'm sort of trapped in between those two poles, and that's the only word I can find for that is agnostic. And when I read you sometimes, it seems that you're kind of in that same position too.
Yeah, I'd say that's right. Again, if we can get away from the labels, because people carry different meanings by those words, like calling yourself a feminist, you know, it's like, I don't really know what's in your mind if I say that. So just, you know, just describe the experience as you just did. Yeah, the awe and wonder, the, you know, the Sagan-esque description of the cosmos, and you know, that opening scene in Cosmos where he's down the coast from Big Sur on Pacific Coast Highway, and the waves are crashing, and he's talking about the, you know, sort of the mystery and awe of the whole thing, and Yeah, that's a form of spirituality. I think a lot of conservative religious people have sort of hijacked that word and said, that's our word. And New Agers have taken the word in yet a different direction, you know, spirituality in a New Age sense. Well, I don't think anybody has a monopoly on that word. I think you, me, lots of people simply look at the wonders of nature and feel a deep sense of transcendency, that there's obviously something grander than me, and the awe and wonder of it and the mystery, and that can evoke the kinds of emotions that anybody would describe as spiritual, and there's lots of ways to get that. You don't have to pray. You can meditate. You can just sort of space out, like in my case, when I'm out on a bike ride by myself, I just kind of space out and enjoy the wind in my face and the sun on my back and so on, and that's a form of spirituality. And I describe in the book going to Mount Wilson and standing inside the dome that houses the 100-inch telescope where Hubble discovered the expanding universe and all that. And wow, I mean, I just get goosebumps when I'm there. And that's a form of spirituality. So I think we can all be spiritual. There's just different pathways to get there. And it's not fair for anybody to claim they have a monopoly on it. And when they do, that's when we start getting into more serious political and social problems with religion.
Mike, can you describe quickly the three models of the relations between science and religion and how they might work? Because then I've got a point that I wanted to make about those, the way you presented them, that bears on what we've just been talking about.
Yeah, well, it's just a useful tool to get our minds around it. The conflicting worlds model is that there's a conflict between science and religion, and you have to pick one. The overlapping model is that science and religion are just two different ways of coming at the same reality, and we can find some sort of bliss by harmonizing the two. And then the separate worlds model, which is that science and religion are really two completely different enterprises that do different things and have nothing to do with one another. And I largely go with the latter one, that most of what religion does when people say they're religious has nothing to do with trying to understand how the world works or what's the origins of life, or you know, where did that tree come from, something like that. What most people mean when they mean by being religious has to do with social aspects and finding sort of meaning or morality, or they go to church for reasons having to do with family and social, their social circle and their friends, and it gives a sense of social fulfillment. And science just doesn't do that. It's not what it's meant to do. And so for the most part, I think you can keep them separate.
This is what Gould said, right, Stephen?
Yeah, the non-overlapping magisteria. Yeah, it's a fine metaphor. I think it's. I think where it can be challenged, where he was challenged, and I have been as well with that, is when specific claims are made by religion that have a scientific bent to them. Well, in that case, now we have a conflict. I mean, either the world is 4.5 billion years old, or it's 4,000 years old. Well, which is it? Well, in that case, we can actually answer that question. So now that's no longer an article of faith. It's not part of religion. It's just an empirical question. How old is the Earth? And so if you insist that it's 4,500 years old rather than 4.5 billion years old, well, then we are going to have a conflict. Yeah, for sure.
So, okay, now I'd like to go back to what we were talking about before. And actually, I'll ask you about a word that you coined in Why Darwin Matters. Let me see if I can pronounce this correctly.
Science-uality.
So explain what that
means. Well, I'm just going for something like sensuality, the sensuality of science, that it can be, maybe spirituality, that's what I mean by that, sensuality. It's just a way of having an emotional experience with a scientific enterprise or the knowledge of science or something like that. It's just a way of showing that science is not just a rational process, that's also an emotional process. And you know, we know from research on the brain, particularly like by Damasio, that you really can't make decisions, rational decisions, without an emotional element to them. We never have enough information. We're always acting under high levels of uncertainty. Think of the stock market, for example. And so no one's actually really rational in that Spock-like sense. We are all pretty emotional. So why not just admit it and say, yeah, science is like that too. It isn't this rational calculating machine. There's an emotional element to it, especially with the results and the implications of science and you know what it means for who we are, like the study that was published this morning in Science about how children are infants are more intelligent than chimpanzees socially. They're socially more intelligent, and that's because we're a more social primate species than chimps. And I get kind of goosebumps over that, findings like that, because it shows that, yeah, we really are a special species because we're so social. And that says something deeply to me about religion, why religion is so successful, because it's so social. It's tapping in to those social networks that are incredibly important for us.
Well, let me just add what that word reminded me of, and your whole discussion surrounding it, is of something I tried to get at in my last book, Rational Mysticism. So I was looking for a way to show that science and religion, or science and spirituality, whatever you want to call it, are in some sense compatible. And I think in lots of ways they are not compatible, and they are in conflict, as your first model describes it. But the one way that they are compatible for me is that they both evoke this sense of awe or even miraculousness. So the way that religion does it is emotionally. So you have various rituals and texts and doctrines that give you a sense of the grandeur of existence and our kind of smallness in relation to God or whatever intelligence is behind all of this. And so that's kind of this emotional, visceral sensation, and sometimes you get that in a really powerful way in a religious experience. And science, I think, leads intellectually to that same sense of wonder and awe. So you've got with science, in spite of all that it has explained about nature, you keep coming back to these core mysteries. The origin of the universe is the greatest one of all. Why is there something rather than nothing? The origin of life is still a complete and utter mystery. And then why, once life began and started evolving, should it create something as improbable as us, these creatures that can ponder their own existence and feel awe and wonder about it? So I see that as actually an example of the kind of convergence that Model 2 is getting at.
Yeah, the shared experience. Yeah, well, the shared experience of that sense of awe and wonder. Yeah, okay, but the problem I have with the convergence model, the overlapping models there, is the attempt to, say, harmonize the book of Genesis with scientific findings and insist that, well, we know Genesis has to be right, it appears to be in conflict, so let's see how we can tweak it and make it fit. I find that a useless enterprise, because I don't think the book of Genesis or any of the books of the Bible are meant to be a science book, a history book, a book of geology, a book of cosmic origins. You know, all origin myths, all myths have origin stories. That's part of it's part of the package. But our origins myth is science. In that sense, science is a myth. It's a storytelling mechanism, but it's a storytelling mechanism with a huge difference. There's at least a way to get at the way that world actually is, despite all our biases. There's some self-correcting machinery built in there. Whereas all previous myths are just, you know, they're just based on where you happen to be born in the world and what your parents happen to believe. So, I mean, so many Americans, what something like, I don't know, 70-75% would call themselves evangelical Christians. Yeah, but if they had been born in India at the same time, they wouldn't be evangelical Christians. They'd likely be Buddhists or Hindus, and they'd believe in Ganesha, the blue elephant god, and they would think that equally rational and reasonable to believe, and they would make arguments for it or something like that. And so my point is that the difference between science and religion, if you went to India, they would not be doing a different kind of physics. They'd still be doing Newtonian mechanics. Say, if India wanted to launch a spacecraft and get it to Mars, they'd have to use the same equations that American scientists use, and yet their religious beliefs are radically different, and that tells us something about the difference between science and religion.
Okay, Mike, now I'd like to bring up another issue that came up for me, actually starting with the first sentence of the dedication page of Why Darwin Matters, and this gets at a a really serious problem for skeptics and something that I've struggled with in my own career. You dedicate it to Frank Soloway. And I find that ironic because elsewhere in your book you talk about how science is this wonderful process, self-correcting process, and how really good scientists dedicate themselves to proving their own theories wrong, and they accept counter-evidence and so forth. And as you know, Frank Soloway, I guess his best-selling book was Born to Rebel, and that book has always really annoyed me because I thought it was such a wonderful example of how social science studies can be sort of twisted around to support any conclusion, particularly if you have a theory with terms as squishy as firstborn child and conservative temperament versus rebellious temperament. So I wrote about Soloway's book in my second book and was very critical of it. And I'm not going to ask you to defend Frank Soloway, although you're certainly welcome to, but there are a bunch of things as I went through your book that you mentioned that I have, there's sort of scientific theories or figures who are peddling certain scientific views that I find lacking all credibility. Another one is Ray Kurzweil. You mentioned him. Kurzweil is somebody who I think of more as a religious cult leader than a true scientist. You mentioned string theory and the multiverse theory, for which there is, some of the smartest physicists in the world support these theories, of course, but there's actually no empirical evidence in support of them. So you see where I'm going. I'm saying that maybe, there are certain skeptics who have, I think, a double standard. There are some kinds of science that they give a pass to instead of applying the same critical standards to them that they would, say, to ESP or intelligent design and things like that.
Right. Okay, well, first of all, I dedicated Why Darwin Matters to Frank because he's one of my best friends, and I spent a month with him hiking through the hinterlands of the Galapagos Islands and camping and all that, and that seemed the most appropriate person to dedicate my book to, and there's no other reason other than that. He's my friend, and that's what you do in a dedication, is you thank somebody special. So as for his theories, well, what Frank does is no different from what any social scientist does. So if you're going to be skeptical of Frank's methodologies, you really would have to be skeptical of most of social science, because that's how it's done. Now, maybe he's wrong, but the process of debate and disputation and no, this theory is wrong because of this data is no different than, let's say, John Lott's book, More Guns, Less Crime, and that book is, debunked by Freakonomics, and then he's got another book out debunking the Freakonomics guys, and, that's the normal part of science, the give and take and rough and tumble, and so what, you do in being skeptical of Frank, that's fine, that's what science does, and string theory, well, just in the last year, there's been two books published skeptical of string theory. Well, hallelujah. It's a good example of how science really does work, that you can speculate all you want. You can start off a research program with, sort of metaphysics and philosophy, and this could be that, and anecdotes and all that stuff. But at some point, you really do have to have some way of testing it. And if you don't, then eventually other scientists or colleagues will just give up and you won't get funding anymore or whatever. And that's okay. That's good. And so I think everything you've described, I largely agree with, is just the normal workings of science. Science doing well.
Well, let me ask you this. I would think one of the toughest jobs for a skeptic is just figuring out what your target should be. There's so many irrational beliefs, and there's this whole sort of spectrum. So obviously, string theory is there's more rigor brought to bear on it, at least mathematical rigor, even if not experimental evidence, than, for example, astrology, or maybe even intelligent design. But how can, with all these targets, how do you decide what to focus on? Do you look for things that you think are particularly harmful for society?
Oh, in our case with Skeptic, we just look for sort of the hottest controversy around. I mean, we're a magazine. We're on the newsstands and bookstores. People want to. They're only going to pick it up if it's something relevant, which is another reason why we don't bother with things like astrology and a lot of these long gone claims, the Hollow Earth or Flat Earth Society or whatever. I mean, we're going for like the vaccination autism thing because it's in the news. It's what people want to know about. 9/11 conspiracy theories, you know. We did a whole cover story on that because it was something like 30% of the American public thinks that the Bush administration either knew something about it or was somehow involved in the attacks on 9/11. It's incredible. But there it is. I mean, I wouldn't have bothered with it at all because to me it's just silly beyond belief. But nevertheless, so many people call us and emails, and there's books and TV shows and documentaries and online films and talk shows covering it. It's like, okay, we have to respond to this, and we did. So that's basically the rule we follow.
Yeah, so more sort of news value, because I would think, you know, obviously when you're talking about autism and the treatments for it and the causes of it, or, you know, we've already been talking about psychiatry and the whole psychopharmacology industry. I mean, this is science that has real consequences for people's health. It has economic consequences. Intelligent design and creationism and all that stuff, I don't know. I suppose the consequences would be if you get somebody, for example, in the White House who holds these beliefs, then it might have negative consequences for the rest of us.
That's
right.
Are
you looking for things that have sort of a, you know, potential real political or social or economic
things that matter. Yeah, definitely, absolutely. Although we don't deal with topics that are largely political or economic, only because there's other people doing it that have much bigger budgets than I have. And I mean, some people say, why don't you track down that whole story about weapons of mass destruction? Well, I mean, you know, 60 Minutes is doing it, and they have, you know, they got $10 million to spend on their investigation. You know, I have, you know, $2,000 to spend on it. You know, what am I going to be able to do? So, you know, we pick and choose our targets. And also that's, you know, so many people are already doing that, you know, I'm looking for areas that other people are not covering, you know, that sort of are in our sphere of influence. And intelligent design might come back. I mean, it was a big court case in Dover, and so, of course, we had to cover that. And they may fade away, but I suspect not. I think they'll keep evolving. And so we'll have to, you know, respond to whatever the next set of arguments are. And that's what we do.
So, in the time we have left, I wanted to ask you about the science of good and evil. Could you describe, I haven't actually read that. I've read about it, and I've read some essays that you've written in which you cite it. So, could you just sort of summarize the
yeah, it's,
of that book?
It's sort of the third in my belief trilogy, Why People Believe Weird Things is about science and pseudoscience, and How We Believe is about why people believe in God, and the science of good and evil is basically why we are moral. And it, from an evolutionary scientific perspective, that is, what's the origins of the moral sentiments, and can you be good without God? So basically that's what that book is trying to address. So the first half is about evolutionary ethics, that is, how we evolved as a social primate species in which cooperation and pro-social behavior and altruism is simply built into us. You have to be cooperative and pro-social. In order to get along with your fellow group members, in order for the group to survive, the social group to survive. And I actually argue that I think Huxley got it wrong in this sense. Huxley portrayed evolution as nature red in tooth and claw, in Tennyson's famous phrase, and that it's nothing but cutthroat competition. And I think, of course, that's partially true, but there's another side to evolution, that is social evolution, what Peter Kropotkin called mutual aid, that also goes on. And we're now just discovering in the last 15 years of research that there's this whole other side, you know, Franz de Waal's research on the peacemaking primates. Yeah, they fight, they bite, they kill each other, they're nasty, but they're hardly ever doing that. Most of the time, they're sitting around grooming each other, eating together, hanging out together, just doing kind of regular stuff that we would do. And so it's not fair to portray a species as all violent and aggressive when, in fact, most of the time they're being pro-social. So that's, I use that argument in The Science of Good and Evil to show that, in fact, we are by nature moral. It is transcendent of you and I. Our morality does not come from whatever you feel like, John, or whatever I feel like. It does come from something deeper, and that's part of our human nature. And in fact, my next book, called The Mind of the Market, basically applies that same principle to the economy and market behavior. That, in fact, free trade, natural trade between people comes very naturally once trust is established between strangers. Once there's institutes in place, political, social institutions that encourage trust, then people will gladly trade with one another because we are so social. And the whole idea of capitalism, I think, has been wrongly associated with that cutthroat social Darwinism. And what we're discovering now is that, in fact, that nice pro-social side of human behavior usually is what you see in the marketplace.
So, Mike, this touches on something that's been an obsession of mine for the last at least 4 years or so. I guess it started really around the time of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. I started noticing in my conversations with people that I've always sort of had this hope that we'll have world peace, as naive and romantic as that sounds. And after 9/11, especially when we attacked Iraq, I noticed when I brought up this possibility of humanity getting past militarism and warfare, people looked at me like I was crazy. It's like I believed in astrology or intelligent design, or even worse.
Yeah, I read that. I read your piece. I don't think there's anything wrong with being sort of optimistic that way. I think that's a good thing. I think the realistic view is that we are by nature pretty tribal and xenophobic and nasty, and that's why we do need social institutions. I mean, in my earlier adult life, I was a pretty strong libertarian, so I would argue what you're arguing, but from a libertarian perspective. That is, once we get rid of tyrannical governments and all government, in fact, then we'll achieve this. Well, I don't think that's true anymore. I think you do need certain social institutions in place, a strong military and so forth, to keep those the tribal nature of our nature in check. But there's nothing wrong with aiming for that. I think it's a good thing.
Well, so let me just ask you, flat out, this is the same question. In fact, I just asked, I had my second introduction to journalism class yesterday, and I mentioned this interest of mine in whether warfare can end, and I asked my students flat out, do you think war will ever end once and for all? And 12 students in the class, and everyone said no. So let me just put that question, and that's pretty much typical. So it's over 90% of the people that I poll in any venue are fatalistic. So, and the ones who are positive, often it's for very disturbing reasons. Like they think that the Christ will return to the earth and we'll have heaven and earth. That kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So let me put that question to you. Expert in
The answer would be, under the current conditions, no. The way political states are structured, no, I don't think it's possible. I think the way to get there would be a slow, gradual attenuation of the conditions that lead to war. So the making political borders much more porous through free trade, for example, would make it much more difficult for freely trading liberal democratic countries to fight one another. This is Thomas Friedman calls this his McDonald's theory of war. It doesn't quite fit that any two countries with McDonald's won't fight each other. Well, they do occasionally. But his point is that the more porous the economic borders are, the less likely those two countries will fight. I call this Bastiat's principle. Friedrich Bastiat has said that where goods cross frontiers, armies won't. Or where goods do not cross frontiers, armies will. People want stuff. They want to, they want to improve their life. And if you don't allow them to do that freely, they may form coalitions and simply go take it. And so that temptation, that tension is always going to be there. For me, free market capitalism is the best way to attenuate it. It's no guarantee, but it at least decreases the probabilities. No two liberal democracies, rarely do two liberal democracies ever go to war with one another. It's almost inevitably some sort of two dictatorships or a democracy against the fascistic or communistic or dictatorship. But two liberal democracies, say Canada and America, this just isn't going to happen. Today,
you're, the European Union is a sort of model for what you'd like to see happen
throughout
the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Although not leading toward one world government, but just leading to porous borders where people can come and go as they please. I mean, just picture it wasn't that long ago when these European states, half a little over half a century ago, were all fighting one another. Well, imagine would France, you know, march its armies through the Channel and try to take over England, or would Germany invade France now? All this is so unlikely, simply because they all have the same currency. That alone makes a big difference.
Yeah, and after all, it's not inconceivable, but it's a lot harder to imagine war between Europe and Russia now.
That's right.
It was 20 years ago. So what about, one last question to sort of come full circle. What about the role of religion in creating a more peaceful world?
Right. To me, as long as the political, economic conditions are there that make it next to impossible for people to want to fight each other, then religion really doesn't matter. It's when religion is married to the state, and the state has tight borders and control over its people, and power, giving power to religion, that's when it becomes dangerous. Religion is a force for tribalism, but for my money, the tribalism and the political tribalism comes first. I think religion is a tool in the hands of political power. So here I differ with Richard Dawkins, who sees the day when if we eliminate religion, it will largely eliminate wars and that sort of thing. No more 9/11, no more 7/7, and so on, as he says. I'd like to believe that's true, but I don't think so. I think those sorts of things would go on anyway under some other excuse. In other words, I think religion is an excuse. And that once we fix the social political problem, it won't really matter what religion people practice.
Well, that's good. That's a pretty hopeful analysis, because the way things are going now, I can't foresee religion. I mean, I think 100 years ago, if you asked leading intellectuals where we'd be now, probably a majority, if not all of them, would say, well, science will have displaced religious belief once and for all. And
yeah, I don't think that's going to happen now.
So, you know, there is something in the human psyche that just really seems to need these sorts of belief systems. So, you know, if we have to depend on the elimination of religion for a peaceful world, then that's really a problem. So I like your analysis better than Dawkins'.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's what I think. Yep.
So, okay, tell us once more when your next book is coming out, and then we'll wrap it up.
The next book is called The Mind of the Market, and it comes out January 08. So I'll be doing a big book tour and lecture tour for that. And so that's it.
Okay, I look forward to
it. Thanks,
John. So thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
Okay, bye.
Talk to you later.